Okay. The person that I wanted to speak about this month was somebody called the Maram Shik. And let me just first just be kids to say when he lived and who he was, and then we'll speak more about Bariches. He was the Chassam Sofer's Choshev Talmud. He was a Chassam Sofer's big Talmud. Chassam Sofer himself lived from 1762 to 1839. He lived from 1807 to 1879. And he lived in Hungary. And he is most noted for probably the struggle against the Reform movement. And he's probably the central halachic authority in Hungary at the time. He was considered the Chassam Sofer's Chash of the Talmud. And that's probably what he's most known for. We'll try to work our way around it and get a sense of it. Before I speak about him personally, I'd like to give some sort of sense of the Tkufa. And when we talk about Reform movement, exactly what we mean. It helps a lot in understanding the backdrop, helps us understand where the thrust of Milchama was and why and so on. So at the end of the 1700s, there were Jews who were beginning for many reasons to start becoming free thinkers, let's say. It followed the pattern of the world, and people, first of all, there was a liberalization and emancipation in different places, and Jews began to absorb a lot of what was around them, and it expressed itself in different ways. In places like France, for instance, assimilation was the thrust of it, as people sort of saw Yiddishkeit as something very, very vague and not so meaningful, they started assimilating to the Goyim. The Jews in Poland and in Russia and in Lithuania, for them, Haskalah was an end into itself, and people looked for education. They dropped Yiddishkeit in different varying degrees, and that was the thrust of that movement in those countries. In Germany, and then by movement into Hungary, the thrust of that movement was Reform movement. They wanted to change the tzura of the worship. You see that the issues that they first began to deal with, and the things that they wanted to strike at, was the worshiping, the ceremony. I guess it's because in Germany and to some extent in Hungary, the shul, the synagogue was like the focal point of Yiddishkeit, certainly in Germany. And any changes they wanted to make, they wanted to do in the shuls. Now, the changes all had a common denominator, and that is kiyadua. Christian worship is a lot nicer, dignified, everything you want, any adjective you want, and therefore we need to put it in line with it. So instead of the chazan facing the you know, away from the audience, you'll face the audience. The bima, instead of being in the middle, will be up front. There will be special garments for the clergy. They will have a choir. They will have an organ. Maybe they'll move Shabbos to Sunday. All sorts of, the focal point of Reform was to make it church-like. And the services would be in the vernacular. They would daven in German if it need be, or Hungarian, or whatever it is. That was the thrust of the Reform movement in Germany, and by extension, Hungary. Now, it's important to remember that, A, there was no Reform movement that sort of had a shita. It's like, you know, they had their shita worked out, it was everybody wanted something else, basically. And it started with people who had normally been Orthodox or Frum, and they were Kali Das, and they slowly began, like, so in 1810 they opened up a temple that had major changes from the form of worship, somebody named Jacobson in Germany. And then they would have conferences where they would get together 20, 30, 40 new type rabbonim, and they would come up with all sorts of things. Another very, very important thing was that they speak all the speeches in the language of the country, so German, Hungarian, whatever it is. Those were all the types of things that sort of they wanted. Now, I want to, the Frum Jewry was very slow in responding. They didn't think it's a threat. They didn't think it would. Also, the idea of any centralized organization was kind of alien to them. Now, let me explain why the synagogues and the kehillas were most important in those days. In those days, in today, for instance, if somebody opens up some new shita, something new I have a different idea, I want to make something, so I open up whatever it is I want to do, a center, a temple, a shul, a shtib, whatever I want, and I either attract people or don't attract people, and that's that. In those days, most of the countries, most of the communities, the money to support the kehilla functions were acquired by a tax on the members of the community. The governments in most places did not particularly care to get involved in Jewish affairs, and different ways and different degrees of autonomy, each community enjoyed an autonomy. They could tax their members, and they did. With the tax, they had the Rav Salad, the Sheikhet, the Talmud Torah, the Echnas HaSorachim, whatever it is that was deemed as important. Whoever collected the tax had phenomenal control. There wasn't money to go around to build alternative moistis. Everything had to be from community. You also had a tremendous amount of power, because remember, most people didn't learn in yeshivas to any extent. Most people, the people who controlled their lives was the community. If you were a Jew and living in a community and you were ostracized, your life wasn't a life. You had no place to go to. You couldn't just melt into a Goyish community. Goyish couldn't accept you either. To be accepted in a Goyish community, you need to be baptized. There wasn't any real Eitzah. So the communities were extremely powerful in terms of providing the services, and also having a very strong hand on forcing people to go in a certain way. Being that, so whoever controlled the community was de facto, that's what the community would be. And that's why the struggle began for the communities. The reformists, they decided to start getting the government involved. In Hungary, we're talking about specifically, and basically they convinced the government that the Jews are backwards and ignorant, etc., etc., because of this. So they proposed to the government that the Jews form a congress, and in 1848, I believe it was, I think it was 1868 actually, 1868. In Hungary, they had what's called the Jewish Congress. By all accounts, it was sort of what's the right word for it? They managed to get more Freie people to be representatives, and once you're a representative, then you know that's you vote like you want to vote, and they basically established. They tried to compromise. The Frum Rabbanan tried to compromise that the one thing that has to be the yesod of this Jewish, all Jewish organization would be that the Shulchan Aruch is binding on everyone, and they were voted out and down. So the vast majority of the Frum Rabbanim left the Congress. They appealed to the king to make their own community, and he granted it. So we have two communities now. We had what was called the Neologian community. Neologian means new theology, kind of the new people. That was one group. And you had the Uraim, which would be comparable to Haredim today. And there was a small group of people, and they formed a group, which is kind of new. From people had never been together in a group. And then you had people, a few communities, Chasher Rabbanim actually, who didn't care to go in either direction. They just didn't want. They preferred that things remain the way they were always, and they were called status quo. Anti, status quo, anti, A-N-T-E. Now, that was the, so you had Neologians who were fairly equivalent to Reform today. You had the Haredim, and then you had the small group of status quo. The Haredim in Hungary, the Frum people in Hungary decided that cutting themselves off totally from the main community is the only way to go. I mean, they totally cut themselves off. You can't get married with their children. You can't eat by them. They really, really separated the two camps. They also fought the status quo people very bitterly. They felt that the status quo people were ruining things, because if every community stays by itself, it'll be captured by the Freie people. So they battled them as well. And that was the status of Hungarian Jewry vis-a-vis the Reform. Relating Ramchik and some of his godless and his points and so on. First of all, where did I get the information from? So there is, always, the most reliable place is his own works. He wrote a tremendous amount. He wrote Chuvis, there's a lot of Chuvis, Chidushim, and there's Igris letters, which tend to be very revealing about a person, his life, and so on. You're never sure that they printed all the letters. Occasionally have letters with piece left out, but by and large, those are extremely good indications. That's one. Two, there is a sefer called Darkei Moshe HaChadosh. Darkei Moshe is a Pirush Ramon de Tur. Darkei Moshe HaChadosh is his biography. It's a collection of Talmidim of his that they asked about him. Talmidim, children, and basically that's what it is. It's simply quotations, extensive quotations from Talmidim, and that's accurate in as much as these are quotations, direct quotes. You also have, I've mentioned his name a few times, somebody named Hugh Greenwald, who was a Hungarian Rav. He ended up in America being Rav of Columbus, Ohio. Wrote called Ben Avelis. He also wrote a lot of historical stuff. And the stuff that writes the historic material, it's done well. He footnotes everything, where he got the information from and what he's quoting and where is he coming from, which is vital to have a sense that the person, at least, there's some basis for what he said. And he also sort of tries to give historical interpretation. I would like to share, it doesn't have to be Ramchik a lot, but I'd like to share two or three points that he makes about the fight of the Frum people against Reform. He obviously was very Frum, he's a Haredi person, but he felt that the way it was fought was inept to the nth degree. He said the Rabbanim didn't recognize the danger as it was happening. They never bothered to take note of what's going on. It wasn't until they actually formed a group and started making a lot of shuls that they finally woke up. That's one. Two, he said they had an asifa for a few days, and he said they came out with what he felt was the most inane, silly sort of summation of the situation. They said the reason why you have to reform is because you have a lot of rabbanim who don't know enough Shulchan Aruch in your day and stuff like that. So from now on, the Rabbanim are going to check up on all the Talmud Torahs and the Hadarim that they're learning well, and that gives smicha, only people know your day and things like that, really well. And Also, people shouldn't just be nichshel ribis. Well, I don't know, not clear what that sheikh has had, and things like that. It seemed he felt this. Rav Greenwald felt that the stupidest part of it was that they prohibited people from speaking speeches in Hungarian. He said the one thing the Reform had going for them was they had very powerful speakers. Their rabbanim were called predigers, which means preachers. And they could speak and sway people. If by tying yourself down to speak only Yiddish, you automatically lost them. And he said, you know, in Germany, Yad Chacham Bernays, who was the Rav Shlomo Hirsch's Rebbe, he was a masterful speaker. Rav Shlomo Hirsch was a phenomenal speaker. Very, very powerful, very inspiring, extremely articulate. And he said, there were a few people who could speak well in Hungarian, and they instead were busy making haramim against them and nisurim against them, and that's why he said they were shooting themselves in the foot. That's his observation. That's his own personal observation. Let's go to the Ramshik. So those are my sources. So the Ramshik came to, he was from a little town called Breise, Moshe Breise. He came to Pressburg, he was a Yasim at a young age. He came to Pressburg as a young boy, maybe 13 or 14. And he was very short also. So he looked like a kid. He wanted to learn about Chassam Sofer. And Chassam Sofer, he was standing, so he came to the yeshiva there, and he told the Chassam Sofer that he wants to come in. And Chassam Sofer looked at him and said, you know, my yeshiva is for grown-up people, not for little kids. And he said a little bit of the word breize. In Yiddish, a breize means a little crumb, a little nothingness. So like he said, you know, I can't take you, you know, you're breizel. So he insisted that if I heard him, the Chassam Sofer was very enamored by him. And Chassam Sofer told him, you'll eat by Mishabasim. He learned 6 years in yeshiva by him. And he ate Shabbos, I think 3 years, he ate Shabbos in Yom Tov, every Suda by the Chassam Sofer. Chassam Sofer adored him. He once fell asleep on the Chassam Sofer, and the Talmid wanted to wake him up, and Chassam Sofer said, It's a shelf of Sfarim laying on me. You can't move the shelf. He was extremely. Now, he himself, his son-in-law writes that the Ramshik told him when he was young, he was very thick-headed, and he said, and the Malamdim had to explain the Gemara over and over to him till he got it, and he said he never let him get it down. He would just keep chazering and chazering and chazering until finally he got it. And he was bekarach of his hasmada. He was noted for his phenomenal hasmada. Everyone who writes about him, he would never mamash pasuk pu megirsei. He was extremely makir, was talmidim about hasmada. That's another, it's part of his personality. He was also stickler for emes and yashris, tremendous anav, and very, very, he had a certain very weighty way of approaching problems. And we'll see. So I first want to look at one or two letters that speak about, I guess, is there Halimud and things of that nature. David, I think you always have the flashlight of some sort. If we can have that, that would be very good. Okay, this I wanted to read two things that are fascinating in terms of his adrocha to Talmidim and his a very sharp letter that he writes to a future son-in-law of his, Divri Musa. He writes a letter to his son, to his oldest son. He says, I'm very happy you got the yeshiva. And you know, this is Hine says, Ahuvi Benisha Yechia. Don't do anything without thinking it through both right and left. You know, look at both sides and then decide what's the Hayasha. In other words, don't do things by whim. Think through something and then go. Every night in Erev Shabbos, make a Chesed Nefesh, what you accomplished that day or that week, if he did a lot or just a bit here and a bit there. And he said it's better to do less but understand the shoresh and where you're coming from and what you're doing than doing a lot but without knowing what you're doing and where you're doing and how you're doing. He said, and don't be somebody who talks more than he thinks. What else he says? He says, everything that you learn, you should have a chavrusa, and a good chavrusa. He says, chazor v'chazor l'itis p'nai b'dor shamat, to keep chazering, and don't wait to chazer till you forget. Let's see what else is interesting. He says, be careful about your health, and don't do things that would damage your health. Don't try to be an oyber chacham and be up at night more than you can. Take a walk every day and speak and learning while you're walking. Cleanliness is a midah that brings to important midas and nefesh, so try to be clean and be oyev shalom and so on. And other things like that also. And he says, answer me in a week or two. And answer your mother in Yiddish, because the Hebrew that you write, she's not going to understand, and she should have a letter and so on. This is one to his son-in-law, future son-in-law. He says, "Achayim Hashalom to the Bocha de Chassan, who is supposed to be my son-in-law. I got your both letters." And he said, the first letter, I see you got a mazel tov, that's nice. The second letter, he said, I saw things that I really feel I need to give you teichacha. His son-in-law had written, his future son-in-law had written to him that he has a skvias that before he goes to sleep, he thinks of learning, and he's writing a chiddush that he thought of then. He says, you write that you think of learning before sleeping. He says, it's not appropriate that a person go around talking about himself if he does something good. He says, the only heter for that is if you want somebody to learn from you. And it's not a derech chachma that a person talk about himself, because in the end people don't even believe it, and they just think you're just boasting idly. So he said, I don't understand, like, why tell me this one of the things you're doing? It's not a novestic, and it's not smart either. Now his second point, he said, you know, when you write somebody Torah, you expect that you write the best. But don't tell me the stuff that, as you're drifting off to sleep, you wrote for me. As I said, and why don't you think that maybe it's a fantasy and not seichel? I said, halavai, what a person works hard on and learns is good. And you write that this just fell into your head as you went to sleep, and you think it's even a mila. He says, and I must tell you that looking at the shtikel Torah, it is karev ledivri chaloimis, he says. And then he says, he knocks off his Torah and so on, and he said, and I want to tell you, I wrote these things because I want to impress on you. You should focus on learning the sugi be'iyun and not waste your time trying to do chidushim, because chidushim come automatically. If you learn well, and you learn shtar chidushim, come automatically, and that's that. So those are two interesting things, just in terms of Hadracha. And in the other ones, in the descriptions in Dr. Moshe Shalom, he has his Seder Yom with Talmidim. So 4 days a week he said a Shir, 1 day a week he Faher the Talmidim. He never ever said a Shir that there wouldn't be a Faher afterwards. Like Yontiv, Shabbos, a Yontiv, he would say like a special Shir in Yonad Yaima, and it'd be a Faher later on the day on the Shir that he said. And he said on a Simchas Torah, the Gabbai was in a good mood, so he made a Mishaberach for the Rav, and he said, Bavur, that he's going to give a Shir without testing. And the Maram Shik said, no way. and you know, he said, that's not what I said, and he gave a test. That was, he was extreme makpid. He writes his Talmidim, and Asmada, I mean, just he writes on Hanukkah, before Hanukkah, he got up and told his Talmidim, anybody is going to play any games on Hanukkah, he goes to play cards, he's play this, that, he said, please leave immediately. No, you know, it's a waste of time, it's nonsense, and so on. The next section in the letters, this is a very, very important, is Rabbanis. Now, let's try to understand a little bit. some of the issues. Like we said before, in those today, we don't actually have that picture so much. Today, the focal points of communities are either Rosh Hashivas, Yeshiva, Rebbes, and Chassidim. A Rav and a community is rare that you have that type of strong leadership. In those days, the Rabbonis was the focal point. And there were a lot of problems, machlokis and things of that nature. And the Ramshik, as the Chashiv, in his early years of his life, first 25 years or so of his rabbinic career, he was in a small town called Yergin, which was like sort of a suburb of Pressburg, or not like a resort area near Pressburg. And was able to sit and learn, basically. And his last 15 years or so, he was in Chust, which was a major city, and it was also a very, very was a center of a whole of Marmarish. And he would answer to Rabban Molova, and a lot of fights. Let me describe. So I want to first Baal Peh describes. So the importance of a Rav's absolute domination of his, you know, of his area, and people not being able to do things without the Rav's consent was vital. He himself, even though he was recognized as the Gadol, if he was asked a Shaila by any community that had a Rav, he refused to answer. He would sometimes write and say, I felt the need to be mefalpa with you, but none of this can be construed to be a psak because you have your local mayor Rav. There are a few letters where he explains himself to a Rav. I happened to be in the town and there was an emergency. There was a Moyle's father was Nifta, and the Shaila should do the bridge or this, and you weren't around. That's the only reason I would answer. I would never answer somebody else's city. That was one thing that was extremely important to him. Two, there would be fights who to take as a Rav, and the fights could turn ugly sometimes, many times. Third of all, you had issues where you had Rabbanim that were Gedolei Torah, but were beginning to become Reform. It's something that we have a very hard time. For us, somebody Reform is born and bred Reform. It's not, imagine somebody that he calls Haggai and Rav so-and-so, but is very, very wary of him, is incredible. But that was the situation. People went from being a Goyen, a recognized Gadol, to being Reform. And so you had a bottom like that in towns that people were becoming wary, and the question was, could they move on? Could they take somebody else? Could they throw them out? And the third issue was, Chassidim were beginning to come into these communities. The Chassidim wanted to open up their own minyanim. Some of the Rabbanim said, no way, I'm the Rav, there's one minyan, there's one minyan, you can't do that. Some of the Chassidim wanted to have their own sheichet. And the Rav would ask the Shechita and say it's Nevela, because he has that ability as a Marad Asra. How should we deal with the Chassidim? They called them Sfardim, that's the way we called them, but it meant Chassidim, this is Sfard. He himself had a fascinating relationship. That someone asked him about it. Ramshik was extremely close to the Sigit Rav, and it was the forerunner of the it was the Yitav Lev, the forerunner of Satma, and there would be Yedidus Atzuma. He used to send anybody who came to for brachas, he used to ship off to the Yitav Lev and say, he knows how to do these brachas, go to him. So he once met, so the Yitav Lev told him, you know what, I'm so tired of you sending people to me, I'll teach you how to do brachas, and you know, you'll be able to do it. That was like, you know, they were joking. On the other hand, there was a different rabbi that lived in his town and never went into the Ramshik to say shalom. And someone asked the Ramshik, like, how do you explain it? The chutzpah. So he said it's like two very different drach and whatever. He was very diplomatic about it. But that was the type of situation. So it undermined also the Rabbanis. How would the Rabbanis react to it? Those are the type of things. First thing I want to read is a letter about somebody who had an issue with a Rav in a town, and people, he spoke out against him and so on. So he says like this, I got your letter, and he says, it bothers me. If B'nai Torah talk openly, in other words, in public, they say that a Rav was wrong in paskening. So he said, I think that's a terrible thing. He says, if you have a problem, go and argue with the Rav. And if you don't seem to come to an agreement, he says, go to a different Beis Din. But he says to go publicly, he says, that's a terrible thing. He then has, there were some parshas over here of, this was a town in Ungvar, where they brought in like a reform type person to take over, to become a sheikhet, and letters back and forth with all sorts of, very strong against. He has no right to go in there. Forget about his religious affiliation. Just talking of, this is another fascinating one. This was a story, this is an example of the type of friction between Chassidim and the Rabbonim. This is written to the Rav in Barsha. And what happened was as follows. The Rav had a Vizhnitsa community that lived in that city. Somebody said that the Vizhnitsa Rebbe had written a sefer called Tzemach Tzadik. There's a sefer Tzemach Tzadik from Vizhnitz. So one of the Chassidim said Tzemach is begematria Menachem. That means that the Rebbe is Mashiach. Serious. So the Rav said that absolutely nonsense, you're not allowed to say it. The Chassidim said the Rav is not Bikiris, he no munus chachamim, and therefore he's totally to be ignored. They took their own sheikhet, they took their own Rav, and they ran with it. And he writes a very strong letter. He said, I was so upset what I heard about what they did to the Rav. He's been 15 years the Rav, and he's an Adam Chashuv. He said, people got up there, and they put him to Cheirim, and the Rav says, I'm willing to go on a Besen to clarify the matter. There was nothing I said that was wrong in anything. So he said, so even though it says, Shemoy ben Achechem, I shouldn't be speaking just having heard from one side, but he said, an issue where people have gotten up and said such strong things about a Rav, really needs a reply. And he says, first of all, the cherem they made has no validity, explains why inside cherem. Secondly, he says, they had no right to cut his salary, no right to take someone else instead of him. It's absolutely usa. He says, if he wants to go to Beis Din, then you have to go to Beis Din. There's no right to do anything even before you go to a Beis Din. And he said, even out here on the other side, there's no way in what you did was right, very powerful. And he says, it brings a vort from some sefer. He says, to you, the Barsha community, how long will you destroy things and burn things with your haram and iduyim? It's no covet for vision to Rebbe, and I'm sure he doesn't want it to happen. And the Chassam Sofer that used to say on a pasuk in Mishle, it says, "Bertzeis Hashem darke ish kam oyver v'yashlim itoy." When Akadosh Baruch Hu likes a person, what a person is doing, even the enemies will live in peace with him. So Chassam Sofer used to say that if two people are fighting and they want different things, they'll never agree. But if they want the same thing and the argument is how to get there, then eventually they can make peace. So it says, "Bertzeis Hashem darke ish." If Ratzon Hashem is what the people want, then there's the next one is a letter from the Siget to him that the people that said this, the Vizhnitz never said it, Chas v'Shalom, and it's Tam Hashek about the Vizhnitz, and they never said such a thing, and the whole Kol Koyer was not at Emes. Things never change, and they claim that the other side made up the things about them and so on and so forth, on and on. There is another one about a Rav in a community, and this is Kloisenberg. And there's an issue over here of they wanted to make Nusach Sfarad. He said, so the Kloisenberg Rav was Glasner, Avram Glasner. Avram Glasner has a great grandson who lives in White Oak and Glasner, and he's he put out a sefer. It's called Dor Revi, and they opened up a Chassidish Minyan, and the Chassidus minyan davened their own thing, and they made their own community basically. So the Rav Glasner wrote, it's wrong, it's awesome. How can they do it? So he says, so he basically makes Seder. He says, listen, it may not be appropriate what they did, but it's not smart to stop it. He said, pure aloha, it's not us 100%. He said, they don't have a right to take away from your salary. They have to keep supporting it, but you should not be stopping them doing what they're doing. And he says, you should only go to Din Torah if money, if there's a monetary issue that they're taking away dues or whatever. But if they're doing right or wrong, leave them be. And Chazal said, and that's that. There's another argument there. There's a Rav who was upset with this community, and the community said that they want to, he writes, this Rav seemed to be much more noted to reform and so on, and he tainted that the new people have no business opening up the community, and you see in his tshuva that he walks a delicate line, like he doesn't want to come out against someone when he's not clear to him if this person is wrong or not, but on the other hand, he doesn't want to prevent the other community from taking somebody. And you see that he sort of walks in raindrops. Someone else was very upset about Sidim, and he said that, you know, compromise is not good. What we should do is we should go to a Bezdin. We should argue it out with Pilpul. In other words, I'll bring Rias. And he told him it's nonsense, there's not going to be any Rias, not going to be anything like that. No one ever won with that. Very, very, very down-to-earth advice on these things. What other things? So a lot of the things are about communities in Rabbanim, modern Rabbanim, the Sfar Rabbanim. Now, that seemed to be a big issue. There's another thing. There was a Rav that they caught wrong things. They felt that the Rav had done some things wrong, and they had many accusations against him. One of them, they felt that he had stolen money from the community. And he writes that he's done which issues and how to resolve them, and when they have a right to push him away, when not. Very, very strong. One more fascinating letter. And this is people, there was a Rav, a very chashuv Rav, in Berlin named Rav Azriel Hildesheimer. Rav Azriel Hildesheimer had a seminary in Berlin. He was a Yari Vachar, a very chashuv person. And Dr. Gretz, who was a historian, sort of the beginning of the conservative movement, he had been actually, he had learned with Reb Shlomo Zalman Hirsch and basically left the Derech. He was somewhere between Reform and Conservative. He had gone to Eretz Yisrael and came back with a terrible report that Eretz Yisrael is terrible and goes on there is horrible and so on and so forth, by the Frum people, obviously. So he writes back a very strong letter against him. So the four tainus that Dr. Gretz had was that there's a lot of politics in Eretz Yisrael, a lot of groups are killing each other. So he writes, yes, it would be better that we miss Achit. But he says, until a Yorna becomes, it's not going to happen. So what's the point of it? Two, that in Eretz Yisrael, even wealthy people would take the money that was collected. They felt it was a school or whatever it is. And he writes on it, Limud Zchus. The third, he writes, Gretz said that because they marry young, they have all sorts of Down syndrome and crazy children, and they're loose and all over the place and so forth. He said he's never seen anything like that. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And fourth, he said that they don't have any schools, so they're very primitive, and so on. And he answers him back very, very sharply about these young people. It was obviously done with the desire to knock the people in Eretz Yisrael, the from people, not any different. There was one more letter that I wanted to share. somebody wrote a sefer in Pressburg, a frum person, and he said he's already put out a sefer that had a lot of askamas. Now, he says, let me quote you a piece from this. He says, he writes that basically that Rabbanim sit and write Sfarim, they learn Pilpul all day and sit and write Sfarim all day on Pilpul and so on. There's not much to add to it, it's just rehashing the same old stuff. They'd be much better off writing all sorts of Rimazim on Chumash, Gematrias and stuff like that. And this is a letter to him, and he writes very sharply about it and so on, but very fascinating. So this was a letter that had a lot of, this was a sefer that had a lot of haskamis, and he really, really writes very sharply about it. Al Kapanim, he really was the one who sort of laid down what I would say the format for Hungarian Jewry and how they would live afterwards. The idea of being mizbadel from the other communities was very sharp. Now, if you'll take a look, and it's one of the things that's hard for us to understand today, since the majority of the issues had to do with the shul, they were like Yaharik Valyaver with things of shuls. It's also gama to daven in a shul where the bima is not the middle. It's also gama to daven in a shul that had a dome on the shul. It's also gama this, also gama that. They were very makrim and hagim. Someone wrote to him that they used to have the drushes before laning, and people coming and going were disruptive, so he moved it to before musaf. And even though it's a little bit of a halachic issue with ashrei, you know, because do you say ashrei before, say ashrei after? So he writes to him, he says, it's best not to change any minhagim. If you have no choice and it's really impossible, fine, it's not a halacha. But as a kav, and the reason was because the reform in Berlin, in Germany and in Hungary, their main thrust was to adapt the customs. And that was what it was about. And therefore, if you gave an inch, you gave a foot, and you gave the whole thing away. I don't know if that applies. So people will quote Hungarian Sfarim, Tshuva Sfarim. This is Osu Gama, Osu Muchlet. This is terrible. This is Yarek Valyaver. It was true in Hungary. In Hungary, the sense was that the battleground is on a Kutzeshel Yud. I have a Mechutin. His name is Friedman. He's a grandchild of Sam Seifer and Ricky Vega. And he lives, he lives in Toronto. He's a sort of a Kailiunga man. I mean, he's an older person. And so he always digs up all sorts of interesting things. He brings one of his tshuvas, are you allowed to carry a nifta on horse and wagon instead of carrying him like they do in a tzolion on your back? And again, he writes that certainly it's not appropriate to be mishana from minhagim, but again, if there's a very big debit and so on. 100 years later, there's a shaila, do you have to use a horse and wagon or can you use a car? And again, it's a very modern thing, and being mishana from minhagim and so on and so forth. There's a lot of poking fun at their fanaticism about minhagim. But the truth was, and in Germany also, the German Jews, they became fanatic about everything because that was the only way to stop it. There are different places where Rav Shlomo Hirsch adapted it in a way that in Germany worked. But in Hungary, the Maharshik was the person who basically led the Muhammad. He himself actually was in favor of having drushes in Hungarian if it needed to be. That was one of the issues that he felt differently about Rabbanim. But once everybody voted against it, he was a Vatel Deiter, and he criticized someone else for doing it. He said, listen, I thought it's right, I think it's right, but if the majority voted against me, you know, we have to go, we should go with the majority. And in many ways, that was the strongest. I knew a Yid, he was an Adam, big Talmud Chacham, And I don't know if the people of you who know of Tzvi Kushlevsky in Eretz Yisrael, very big Rashi, very Chasham Chacham, his father was of Elia Kushlevsky. He had learned with my father together in Litta, in Slabotka, and he was a neighbor of mine. And a very thoughtful person, very intelligent person. I mean, he's a big Talmud Chacham. He was a Rav in Be'er Sheva for many years. He told me that as a Bacher, he decided to go to visit all the different countries in East Europe. He was an interesting person. He liked to. And he said, the only country that Yiddishkeit would have survived if not for the war was Hungary. He said, in every other place, it was a downhill. Everything was going downhill. And Hungary was the only place where he saw a viable community continuing. And he was no fan of Hungarians, I assure you. He was a Litvak through and through. There was nothing. He said it out of a sense of begrudging emes, not out of being a fan of it. But Lemaisa, it was him. And you know, the strength of Rabbanis, the strength of community, and the chachma of understanding that the Chassidim, despite the fact that they're not doing right the way they're going about it, you have to learn to live with them, because Yiddishkeit will stay with them. The Yireim, the Shleimim, you have to figure out a way to live with them better. Okay.
You're saying new order or
form? What?
You're saying new order or form?
Same thing. I mean,